Hello and welcome to the Libertarian Podcast. I'm your host, Troy Sinek, joined, as always, by the Libertarian himself, Professor Richard Epstein, Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, as well as Professor of Law at NYU and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, God and Money at Yale. And Richard, that is the somewhat tongue-in-cheek way that I'm going to get us into a story that touches on a lot of themes we've discussed on the Libertarian Podcast over the years. And this story comes to us out of Yale, where the law school, of which you were an alumnus, has just instituted a new policy as to under what circumstances their students can receive various kinds of financial assistance. I'm setting that up in a way that sounds rather prosaic. I assure you it's not. So why don't you start, Richard, by describing exactly what policy changes Yale is making and why?
Well, this is something which came to me out of the blue from a letter. And what it indicated is that the Yale Law School Federalist Society had invited to its campus the woman who had been active in defending the baker in the Masterpiece cake case. And large numbers of students were outraged and appalled that somebody of that particular point of view with an explicit contrition orthodoxy should be allowed to speak on campus. And then slowly the protest moved from a discussion of an individual case and morphed into a discussion of under what circumstances should these various kinds of organizations receive any kind of funding or protection from the Yale Law School. The traditional view with respect to most of these law schools, Yale included, was that when students joined the school, if they decided to do public works, service work of one sort or another, they would be, for example, a loan forgiveness program, which would make up from the fact that they're not earning nearly as much in these programs as they would if they turned out to work for a private firm. And so what happened is the dean, Heather Gerken, after consultation with her entire senior staff on the urging of some 20-plus student organizations, announced a policy which says that the people who are involved in the Alliance for Freedom and so forth should understand that the Yale programs having to do with loan forgiveness for public interest career will not apply for those students that discriminate on the grounds of sexual orientation, gender identity, and expression. So if you want to work for the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty or to defend a Orthodox Jewish group or to work at the BYU Law School, Brigham Young University, what will happen is Yale won't stop you from doing those jobs, but it will take away from you the kind of funding and support that it would give to everybody else. And so the law school is now injecting itself into a form of viewpoint discrimination in the way it gives out money. And what they said is, look, we give lots of money to Outlaw, which is the gay rights organization, and they say we cherish and love all of their particular members. I didn't see anything in the announcement that came from the dean's office, which they cherish all of their evangelical Christians. So it turns out that what has happened is that the Yale Law School, prompted by this event, has decided to take sides on a substantive issue of great pith and moment, leaving many people, myself included, quite distressed as to how it is that a law school like Yale can have such a dogmatic view with respect to discrimination that no other value and no other reason seems to enter into the discourse.
So I'm going to pitch this next question to you, Richard, in very broad terms. But the reason I'm going to do so is because what's clear when you hear the contending sides of this argument is that they are speaking in two different languages. So maybe your answer here can help translate. The word, as you indicated, that critics use to describe groups like the Alliance Defending Freedom is discrimination, meaning there are certain kinds of people that they won't hire. The phrase that defenders of groups like that will use is freedom of association, by which they mean they have the right as a mission-oriented institution to only select people who are on board with that mission. Is that – for people who are trying to parse this, is that just a rhetorical game where it's discrimination if it's something you don't agree with and freedom of association if it's something you do? Or are there meaningful distinctions between the two if we understand each of the terms correctly?
Well, I think there is a very powerful place for both an anti-discrimination norm and for freedom of association, so they don't always have to be at war with one another. The question is whether or not these particular cases having to do with matters of faith are there. So to go back historically, a non-discrimination rule has always been part and parcel of our legal culture going back to the 17th century, and nobody thought it had anything to do with gay rights or similar types of issues. The basic intuition was if you were a common carrier, if you were a public utility, if you were a hotel, and you had were the only place in town at which a certain service could be provided, you were allowed as a firm to supply that service, but you could not discriminate against various individuals for any reason when it came to access for that service. The theory was that if you allow, say, the only railroad in town to decide who's going to travel and who's not going to travel, those people who are excluded have nowhere else to go. They're going to be left in desperate straits. So the rule was that you can charge enough money so as to cover your cost and make a reasonable profit, but you could not pick favorites amongst your potential customers so that some whom you like are going to be prejudiced in their favor, some that you don't like are not. And those rules were called the RAND rules, reasonable and non-discriminatory rates. And it was essentially a self-conscious limitation on the doctrine of freedom of choice. And I have taught these doctrines for years and am strongly in favor of their application. Many hardline libertarians are saying, I don't care whether you're a common carrier or not a common carrier. You can always charge whatever you want to whomever you want. I think that's a mistake. I think monopoly is a very important third category between physical coercion on the one hand and pure competition on the other. There is no need for a FRAND obligation. When you're talking about a purely competitive market, if some guy tries to raise the price on you, there's somebody else who will give it to you at a level, and so the market will equilibrate. You don't think about FRAND obligations when it comes to beating people up. You don't want to say to people, I will only beat you up if you pay me or don't pay me a certain sum of money. So the middle category is there. When it got to the discrimination laws in the civil rights period, 1964, this distinction was understood, but it was no longer thought to be dispositive. And so what they said is any kind of, quote, public accommodation, whether or not it had a monopoly characteristic, a restaurant, for example, would have an obligation to serve all comers. And I thought that that was a mistake, and I thought it was also a mistake to do that in employment markets. And when I wrote a book called Forbidden Grounds in 1992 and an article in the Stanford Law Review in 2014, I sort of indicated to myself that the older view, use anti-discrimination laws to count the monopoly, was indeed the correct one, and these modern things are only going to lead to trouble because the state's going to have too much power in the way in which it directs. This was actually something that was understood in 1964. And so when they were doing these debates about the anti-discrimination norms, there were long discussions about where they applied and where they did not apply, and there were at least three exceptions that everybody kind of understood were there. One is they were very small kind of business organizations, rooming houses and so forth. So your firm under 10 people, if it turns out you want to lend out rooms with a common bathroom, for example, in your house to two or three people, the non-discrimination norms did not apply. You're not going to tell the 65-year-old woman that she has to take in a young man into the premises and share a bathroom facility with her. And then on the second part, there was what they called BFOQs, bona fide occupational qualifications, which did not apply to race, but did apply to both sex on the one hand and to religion on the other. And the basic conceit that they had is that these are sex differences. It really makes a difference as to whom you share your room with and all the rest of that stuff. And if it turns out that there's some cases where sex really matters, you should be allowed to take it into account out from underneath the anti-discrimination law. And they had exactly the same view with respect to religion. Now, unfortunately, the BFOQ rule has been construed very narrowly by the judges, but at least you understand what's going on. And their argument was, even if you're going to have a non-discrimination rule for economic relationships, you don't want to have it with respect to religious organizations where the sensitivities turn out to be very much greater. And on matters of faith, we don't want to have forced association. And so the civil rights laws clearly support the Christian groups in what they're doing. In fact, I'll just make one other observation. It's not just the question that these groups, or some of them don't want to take other people. Some of them simply want to give preferences to their own people. And that often happens with respect to religious hospitals, less so today than in ordinary days. And what the Yale people said is anybody who discriminates for any reason against anybody, we will basically exclude them from the set of benefits that we have in these cases.
Richard, there's a certain strain of libertarian that might look at this and say, well, I think this is kind of stupid or offensive. But Yale is a private institution. It's not run by the federal government. It's not run by the state of Connecticut. So really, they should be free to do whatever they like. What's your response to that?
Well, I mean, I have two responses. One is they may be free to do whatever they like as a legal matter, which they're not. But I think it's extremely important to understand that organizations do not live by legal norms alone. And in fact, one of the great weaknesses of hardline libertarian theory is the only thing that they seem to care about is whether something is or is not a trespass against the law. They don't care about the role in the application of soft social norms, which essentially would allow these institutions to flourish. And one of those soft norms that you have at a place like Yale is that we let in all sorts of people who disagree with one another. What we do is we require norms of civility in their interaction, but we think that everybody is going to be better off if rival voices are going to be heard, notwithstanding the fact that we disagree with them. So if you were a liberal back in 1955 and the question was whether or not you were going to allow a communist to come on campus and to speak, the standard liberal response, which I share then and now, is yes, you do let this person come on and speak unless he's prepared to do immediate physical violence, and you are free to disagree, you are free not to attend and so forth, you are free to argue or not argue as you may see fit, but you don't want to basically take a university and turn it into a selective forum. And I think that particular set of social values is lost when large numbers of the Yale faculty and student body now think it's perfectly okay to say that we're going to have only one side of a particular debate there. And so what happens is anybody who wants to attack Masterpiece Cake Theater can say whatever they want, whereas anybody who wants to defend them under these circumstances is going to be under a serious disability. And so the first answer is it's not just a matter of law that's going on here. There's a matter of really the question of can you maintain a healthy intellectual environment in any public or private institution if you have these kinds of viewpoints, kinds of discrimination. The second point is that Yale essentially is trying to make believe that it lives in a 19th century world when it comes to freedom from discrimination. It is, of course, bound by the anti-discrimination norms that are built into these kinds of statutes. And so the question is, when it starts to say that we're going to give preferences to one group of people over another group of people, and you do have statutes which say that you're not allowed to discriminate against groups on the grounds of their religious affiliation, they may well be in violation of the particular law, because I think it's not very difficult to say that there's a huge anti-religious animus that's involved in this particular case. And so if you want to do this, it's a private institution subject to a civil rights regime. It's no longer a private institution that's not. This is very parallel to the situation on the Asian exclusion with respect to Harvard, in which Harvard, another great Ivy League institution, takes the following view. All anti-discrimination laws apply to lesser mortals than to us, but we're entitled to have, given our huge expertise, the right to determine what the composition of our student body is, and we should therefore not be bound by Title IX under these cases. But they are bound by it, and it seems to me if you actually go back and ask yourself whether or not they've taken race into account when they're dealing with the Asian exclusion, it's painfully obvious that they do. And I think that's exactly the problem here. For my own self, I'm less worried about the legal kinds of argument. I think, in effect, that, you know, I'm a graduate of the Yale Law School. I'm simply appalled when a place where I got a pretty good legal education some 51 years ago has turned essentially into a situation in which the students gang tackle anybody whom they disagree with. If you recall, Yale essentially was supposed to organize busloads of students to go down to Washington, D.C. To protest against the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh for the United States Supreme Court. I do not think it is the function of an institution to give students time off in order to engage in their kinds of political activities and to do it on a monolithic sense. So a student body, which has managed to contrive itself so that there are probably, you know, 85% and 90% of the students who are on the left, a very large fraction of them are relatively militant, I don't see how, in effect, it can survive as an institution if it's going to take, to use an old phrase, a discrete and insular minority like the evangelical Christians, and subject them to disproportionate sanctions. If you go back to the 1930s and so forth, in the beginnings of the movements to racial justice, the famous phrase from Justice Stone was, we have a discrete and insular minority that cannot protect itself in the political process, so the court has to come in and help them. Well, you try to figure out what the status of evangelicals is at the Yale Law School or the Yale University. They're the ones who need protection, but instead the administration has turned against.
The last question that I'll ask you about the broader context here. The argument you're getting from the left over the last decade or so seems to be, and I'll stipulate that this is implicit, you rarely hear it delivered quite this clearly, but it seems to be, we're fine with you having your religious freedom, but what that means in practice is that you get to believe in what you want, and you're free to follow the dictates of conscience within the four walls of your church or your synagogue or your mosque, what have you. But we are defining the sphere of public space in which you cannot live out those convictions without running afoul of law or policy much more expansively than we used to. In other words, free to do what you want as long as it's essentially a purely private matter. What's wrong with that view?
Well, first of all, that argument is made expressly, and one of the ways in which it's put is that if you're talking about religion, you have a freedom of worship, but you do not have a broader freedom for the free exercise thereof. Right. If you start to look at the constitutional guarantee, it is not couched in terms of worship. It's couched in terms of the free exercise thereof. And so what does that mean? It means, suppose that you are a very devout Jewish person and you like to wear a yarmulke or a skullcap of one form or another. If you were to take this argument legally, then what the government could do is to decide that anybody who wants to walk in public is not allowed to wear various kinds of headgear, which indicates some kind of religious affiliation. In addition, it's exactly the same kind of thing that you can start to say with respect to Masterpiece. You're allowed to make cakes, but if you want to make these cakes, you can only make them on the terms and conditions that we're allowed to do so. Now, why is this so incredibly dangerous? It's because the state at this particular point has and exercises a very powerful form of monopoly power. And if you take the fair, reasonable, and non-discrimination principle seriously, and it wants to say to a group of religious individuals, you have to leave that stuff at home, and then you want to say to a group of gay activists, you're free to do this in the public sphere, what you've fundamentally done is to put the government on one side of the debate. So if you go back to what happened in the Masterpiece Cake Theater, there was an interesting disagreement between Justices Gorsuch and Kagan, and what happened is the question came up in Colorado. Is somebody goes to a gay baker and they want them to bake a cake, and what the cake is going to say, marriage is a union between one man and one woman. And if this guy is a public utility, then he's going to have to do it. But that's not the position that they took. What they took is that the gay baker, in effect, now the religious baker must make the cake for the gay couple, but the gay baker can simply say, I find your message offensive and I don't have to do it. So what we do is we end up imposing common carrier obligations on our opponents, and we don't impose them upon our particular friend. And it's that fundamental asymmetry that's so utterly deadly in this kind of case. At the Yale Law School, the majority is clearly in favor of a very liberal kind of practice, and what they're trying to do now is to make their lives easier. And what they should do is they should realize that they are the dominant power in this particular case. They can't constantly say under these circumstances that they're isolated and impoverished, subject to victimization and discrimination. They're the guys who are ruling the roost. And what they want to do is they want to abuse other people. And could you imagine if this had been the other way around and it turns out you've got militant Christians out there and what they decide is that no gay person is entitled to move in public in a way that shows that they're gay. So you're not allowed to hold hands in public if you're a gay couple. You can do it in private only within the confines of your own home. I think what is so utterly frightening about this is the complete, utter unawareness of highly sophisticated people that what they're doing is they're engaging in rules which line and feather their own nest and simply take it out of the hides of everybody else. If every university in the country were to follow that, it would be appalling. What I think happens now is if somebody asked me whether they should teach at Yale or whether they should go to Yale, I would tell to them, look, I got a fine education there, but I could not imagine myself being in that environment. Would I accept an invitation from the Federalist Society? I would regard that as a duty to do so in order to hold up the flag on the other side unless I get banned or shouted down. But the whole incident is a sign of the increasing authoritarianism which is associated with the anti-discrimination movement, and it all stems from a political movement which does not understand the following basic principle. Every good idea in its most general form should be subject to some kinds of exceptions so as to create some kind of balance within the system. That was understood imperfectly in the Civil Rights Act of 1964. It turns out to be widely forgotten today.
You've been listening to the Libertarian Podcast with Richard Epstein. Remember, you can follow Richard on Twitter at Richard A. Epstein. You can read his weekly column, The Libertarian, by visiting Defining Ideas at hoover.org, and you can help us out by rating the show on iTunes. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.